You know, it's funny. I was thinking as we went through that last song. I mean, I love that song. And didn't the choir do a great job on all those songs? Yeah. They work hard. This whole choir is more homework than anything else. And they do their homework and they show up and they... I told them, I don't know how to lead a choir. All I know how to do is tell you what you're doing wrong. And that gets a little old after a while, but really that's about the extent of that's all I have to offer the choir anyway. They do a great job and they're faithful it's been over a year now that we've been doing this Communitas choir thing. And anyway, all of that to say, I really enjoy being able to just play the guitar and not have to lead the singing too. Because usually when I split my brain that way, that neither one of them gets done really well. And there was a moment there in that last song where I was just really enjoying myself on the guitar. And it reminded me of a time, this has nothing to do with the message, this is just, I'm telling you a story. Reminded me of the time I was playing acoustic guitar in the big band down at Crossroads. The big band, big stage, the Hollywood lights and giant video screens and, you know, this big whoop-de-doo thing. And the worship just got good. I mean, it got rich and it got strong. And it was my job to play the acoustic guitar. And, man, I was playing it. And I was loving it. I mean, I was just, you know, could not have been more caught up in the moment. And then we got done and some guy came up to me and he goes, you know, I saw you up there playing the guitar. And he goes, are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm okay. What do you mean? He goes, well, you know, I know you have a bad back. Is your back bothering you? Well, you know, not until just now anyway, you know. And he said, well, you look like you're in pain. And I thought, well, I do. I kind of screw up my face. I said, man, that just means I'm really having fun. So, you know, I sort of caught myself in that grimace of joy, of worship up there. Anyway, so much for that. Have you ever noticed how at Christmas time you give the best gifts to the people you love the most? I mean, there's a big difference between your kids or grandkids and your, you know, step-brother-in-law twice removed. You know what I mean? The grandkids or the kids, they get that $100 full-auto rapid-fire Nerf machine gun. And you know they're going to lose the little Nerf bullets in the first 2 minutes, but, you know, you want to see the look on their face. And, you know, the step-brother-in-law twice removed, he gets that $5 Starbucks card, you know, that you kind of, as an afterthought. It's true. The people that you love the most are the people that you give the best gifts to. Remember playing that old game? You pick a daisy or something. It's, he loves me or she loves me. She loves me not. She loves me, she loves me not. And when you get to the end of the last one says, she loves me not, then you just look for another daisy. You got to find one with the right number of loves me's on it. You know what I mean? Well, it seems like sometimes we play, he loves me not with the Lord. You know, we don't necessarily pick a flower and pull the petals off, but just with the things that come into our lives, we tend to see that, we tend to take that he loves me not, based on what's going on. You know, it's easy to see. I got a raise at work. He loves me. Ooh, I got laid off. He loves me not. I read something in the Bible today that just inspired my socks off. He loves me. My child is really sick. He loves me not. I gave money to somebody who really needed the help. He loves me. I let my anger get the best of me. He loves me not. You know, something I prayed for actually happened. He loves me. I stretched the truth a little bit to get out of a tight spot. I guess he loves me not. A friend called out of the blue, unexpectedly, just to encourage me and tell me that they miss me. He loves me. My car needs a new transmission. He loves me not. Isn't that how we do it? We, whatever comes our way, good news or bad news, we turn it into a he loves me not pedal on that daisy of life. And I know we've all been tossed by circumstances, wondering if God really loves you at all the way he says he does. Now, we usually take one of two approaches when God doesn't show his love the way we expect. Something comes into our life and it's one of those loves me not moments. And we think, you know, if God loves me, he wouldn't let this happen. How can he be so callous if he loves me? Or, on the other hand, something comes into our life that's not so great, and we start making a list of our faults and our failures, trying to rationalize for ourselves why he couldn't possibly love us. Well, that's why there's bad news in my life. The Lord doesn't love me because of all the ways I've let him down. The fact is, however, that God has never acted for one minute in any way other than with a depth of love that absolutely defies human understanding. It's just that he often doesn't do what we think his love would compel him to do. And then we start pulling on the pedals. He loves me. He loves me not. Christmas, of course, we talk about where our thoughts are centered around the birth of the Lord, the birth of Jesus, the incarnation, his time here on the planet. Imagine for a minute how Jesus' first followers acted around him when they first met him or before they knew who he really was. The fact is that they didn't know who he really was, even though he told them just point blank who he was and what he was there to do. Even then, they didn't get it until after the resurrection. Think back on those early days. You know, Jesus is baptized by John the Baptist, and immediately a couple of John's followers go to John and they say, we want to follow this guy. And that's when John says that great, he must increase, I must decrease. And so it's John, and if I remember right, Andrew, who now become disciples of Jesus. And you think about, you know, they go and they say, you know, we want to follow you. And he says, well, I'm not really going anywhere. I don't have a home. You know, the birds have nests and the foxes have holes, but the Son of Man doesn't have a place to lay his head. And they said, well, we don't care about that. We just want to go where you go and be a part of what you're doing. But they really didn't get who he was. And because of that, I think the probability is very strong that they just acted normal around him. I mean, if you know you're going before the God of the universe, you know, your head is down and it's, you know, I'm not worthy and it's, O Lord, I sayeth unto thee. And you know, and it's this kind of uptight, formal, you know, a lot of fear, a lot of intimidation about the whole thing. But they didn't know who he was. He was a itinerant preacher who came along one day. And so they wanted to follow him. And, you know, I'll just bet they acted completely at ease. They acted normal, I guess you could say. They weren't self-conscious. They didn't worry about his reaction. In other words, they were free to be themselves. You know what I mean? When you first meet someone, for the first little bit, there's a little tension, a little distance there, but it doesn't take long, a few minutes, a couple of hours, until a certain amount of familiarity comes in, and then, you know, you feel free to just kind of be yourself. You're not, you know, you don't realize you're talking to the Creator and Lord of the universe. It's just John's cousin from Nazareth. Free to act normally. Probably, I would guess, free to talk normally, you know, speak freely, to laugh, to ask what you may think is a stupid question, a question you'd never ask God. You know, just to relax and be themselves. I'll even bet that those rough-handed fishermen told a couple of jokes in those early days that kind of made you go, I don't think I'd have told God that one. But they didn't know who he was. And because of that, they were completely at ease with him. You know, I get a little, just a tiny taste of that. I like to go out before the service and kind of wander around out there. Hopefully, you know, when all the preparations are made and I kind of have a few minutes just to wander and meet people, maybe new people that come in or people that I haven't really got to know yet. And, you know, hi, how you doing? Oh, my name's Ron. What's your name? You live around here? Where do you work? What do you do? Are those your kids? Well, you know, there's the nurseries down there and the Sunday school's downstairs and we'll let them go after we sing. And oh, they're the restroom over there. And, you know, you just kind of get to talk about things and, oh yeah, my kids are grown and just making small talk and get to know them. But then, you know, we come in here and it's 10 o'clock and I put on the Burger King headset and everybody, we have a service and we sing and there's a study. And then, you know, we go back out there and people are different. Oh, I didn't realize you were the pastor. I never would have told you, you know, about, you know, my dog getting sprayed by a skunk. I mean, what's that got to do with anything? But see, those are the things that I like to hear. I don't like it when people are treat me different because of the way I serve the Lord or because of a title, you know, a position that he's called me to. And I'm sure the Lord felt the same way. I mean, isn't that why he became one of us? We have this tendency to be uptight with God. And maybe that's why Jesus snuck up on us in disguise. See, in Jesus, God disguised himself as one of us because he wants, more than anything, to relate to us as friends. And with the birth of that baby, for the first time since the Garden of Eden, God could experience the kind of relationship with people that he had in mind when he created us. Nobody's uptight around a little baby. Nobody's uptight around a little boy. As a matter of fact, it's, you know, hey, hush up over there. Get out of there. Leave those sheep alone. You know, you don't have any problem just being yourself around a little boy, and he grows into a young man, you know. And the people that he met had no idea that they were talking to God incarnate. And I'll just bet you that he loved that. I'll just bet you that's why he came in disguise like that. And then, just as he was about to remove that disguise, he taught us how to stay in that intimate, personal, best friend kind of relationship with him. Remember the upper room. It hasn't been too long since we did a whole series, several weeks, on just the upper room discourse from John's gospel. It was the last night before the cross, which I now refer to as BC, before the cross. Turn in your Bibles to John 14. Just want to revisit one little piece of that evening. John 14, verse 18. Remember now, even the ones who get it don't really get it. They may have heard what he said. They may think they understood what he said, but they're still kind of puzzled and baffled about how could that be? How could he be, you know, my Father and I are one? Well, now, how did he mean that exactly? In verse 18 of John 14, he said, I will not leave you orphans. I will come to you. A little while longer and the world will see me no more, but you'll see me. Because I live, you will live also. At that day, you will know that I am in my Father and you in me and I in you. Now look what he's doing. He's describing this relationship. He's lived with these fellows for the better part of 3 years. He's got to know them. I mean, you know, it was John and James. Well, you want us to call down thunder from heaven? Well, you probably wouldn't do that if you realized who you were talking to. But see, they were free just to be themselves. And what he's saying here in verse 20, you will know that I'm in my Father. He says, you know, we're best friends. We have this relationship. We have this spiritual connection with each other. And you know, you're going to know that I am in my Father. So the relationship that you and I have is a relationship that I have with my Father. I am in my Father and you in me. And I in you. He's teaching them that the relationship they had with him would become a relationship with the Father through his resurrection in the Holy Spirit. Because what he goes on to explain is that after he leaves, he's going to come back. He will not leave them orphans. He's going to come back and not just be with them, but his Spirit, the Spirit of God, will be in them. He says, you're not just going to have a relationship like we have now. You're going to have a better relationship. You're going to have a deeper relationship. You're going to experience my presence so long as you're open to it. So long as you surrender to it, you're going to know my presence. You're going to know my influence. You're going to know my wisdom. You're going to know the fellowship of my people. Just the same way that we've walked these hot, dusty roads around Israel. The reason for the birth, life, death, and resurrection, as they say, the reason for the season. I like that. The reason for the season is God's love for you. We don't have to play, he loves me, he loves me not. The birth of Jesus and everything that followed, life, death, resurrection, ascension, it all shows us that God gives the best gifts to those that he loves. And he gave his son. Turn up just one page to John 15, one verse. John 15, 15, Jesus says, no longer do I call you servants, for a servant doesn't know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all things that I heard from my Father, I have made known to you. Friends. God has given the best gift, the gift of friendship, to everyone who will trust him, even you. Because he loves you and he wants you to know he loves you, even when the circumstances might make you think he loves me not. Now, this is especially relevant. You know, the weeks coming up to Christmas, as I thought about this day and this service and what the Lord would have me share, of course, had no idea that we would all be facing a tragic loss. But it's so wonderful the way the Lord works these things out. Because here we are in the middle of a message talking about he loves me not. And then something happens to us and to Dan's family that would just make anyone say, he loves me not. He must not love me. If he loved me, things like this wouldn't happen. Let me read you a little bit from this book by Wayne Jacobson, just a couple of paragraphs. It's a true story. In a Bible study recently, I met a 40-year-old woman who was active in her fellowship, but admitted to a small group of us that she'd never been certain that God loved her. She seemed to want to tell me more, but finally only asked me to pray for her. As I did, asking God to reveal just how much he loved her, an image came to mind. I saw a figure I knew to be Jesus walking through a meadow, hand in hand with a little girl about 5 years old. Somehow I knew this woman was that little girl. I prayed that he would help her discover a childlikeness of spirit that would allow her to skip through the meadows with him. And when I finished praying, I looked up at her eyes, brimming with tears. "Did you say meadow?" she asked. Well, I nodded, thinking it odd that she'd focused on that word. Immediately, she began to cry. And as she was able to speak, she said, "I wasn't sure I wanted to tell you. When I was 5 years old, I was molested in a meadow by an older boy. Whenever I think about God, I think about that horrible event, and I wonder why, if he loved me so much, he didn't stop that from happening." She's not alone. Many people carry scars and disappointments that can appear to be convincing evidence that the God of love might not exist, or if he does, maintains a safe distance from them and leaves them to the whim of other people's sins. I don't have a stock answer for moments like that, as if any could be effective in the midst of such pain. I told her that evidently God wanted her to know he had been there with her, and that although he didn't act in the only way she could understand true love to act, he loved her nonetheless. He wanted to walk her through that defiled meadow and redeem it in her life. He wanted to give her a measure of joy in the face of the most traumatic event of her life and turn what had destroyed her ability to trust into a stepping stone toward grace. I know that can sound almost trite in the face of such incredible pain, but the process has begun for her. 8 months later, I received an excited email from her telling me in 270-point type, "I get it." Does that mean she understands why it happened to her? Of course not. Nothing could explain that. But it does mean that God's love was big enough to contain that horrible event and walk her out of it. It's my hope that these words will encourage that process in you as well. I love that last part. It means that God's love was big enough to contain that horrible event. Those things that happen to all of us, the loss of a loved one, some trauma, some tragedy, some abuse, whether it's a big thing or a little thing, it's a big thing to you, it's a big thing to me, but it fits inside of God's love. It's not outside or apart from God's love. We have this gift. His name is Jesus. And he is God's gift of love to each one who will receive it.